We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus, we'll be taking a look at what has changed in American religion over the past 50 years. And our guest for the program is David Campbell. He's professor of political science at University of Notre Dame, and he is the co-author of a recently published book that we'll be talking about. The title is American Grace: How Religion Divides and Unites Us. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And he and his co-author for the book, Robert Putnam, make the argument that while in the past, certainly there were religious tensions in this country, they were mostly between religions. Today, they write that the most noticeable shift has been the growing split between those who believe and those who don't. They write in the book that today, while the country remains on average a highly religious nation, that average hides a growing segment of the population who do not believe at all. Our guest David Campbell is the John Cardinal O'Hara Associate Professor of Political Science at Notre Dame, also founding director of the Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy. He is an expert on religion, politics, and public policy. The book is out now, and questions and comments are welcome. We urge people, please, to be brief in your comments and be on the topic. But, of course, listeners are welcome to call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You may also send along your comments by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Campbell, hello.
Hello, it's great to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. And I think maybe right up front, we want to make the point that, well, first of all, that there is a lot in this book. There's a lot here. So we'll try to hit some of the main points. And then people, if they'd like to read in greater depth, they should take a look at the book. That's one thing. And the other thing is to say that now this book is based on a couple of recent and very comprehensive surveys that you were involved with that sampled people's religious experience, their attitudes, what they thought about people of other faiths, the role of religion in society, on a broad range of subjects.
That's right. We like to describe these surveys that we've done as the most comprehensive surveys that have probably ever been done on the question of Americans' religious beliefs, their religious behaviors, and then all sorts of other things about them, so that we're able to really dig deep to understand just how religion works in American society.
Mm. The main point here that you make is that, as I kind of alluded to in the introduction, is that while there remains some religious tension in this country, tension between people of different faiths, that if you look back in American history, there have been times when that's certainly been worse. You don't have to go back very far before you find, for example, real significant tension between Protestants and Catholics. But that kind of tension, largely with some important exceptions that we can talk about, that kind of tension largely has melted away.
That's right. And in fact, it's melted away to the extent that many Americans today are really unaware, or at least it's not in their consciousness, that there was once a time when America was actually quite a religiously segregated society. I mean, it was only back in 1960 that John F. Kennedy had to convince Protestants that it was okay to vote for a Catholic for the presidency. And when John Kerry ran in 2004, also a Catholic, and in many other ways very similar to John F. Kennedy, the fact that he was Catholic really wasn't an issue at all, or if it was an issue, it was people saying he wasn't Catholic enough.
And so what we have now is an amazing, again, with some exceptions we can talk about, some amazing levels of religious tolerance in this country, to the point where, and I was actually, I guess, a little surprised to read this, that there among Christians, there seems to be very high level of acceptance of the idea that a person not of your faith or at least who attends a different congregation, is capable of going to heaven, is eligible of going eligible to go to heaven, even though they believe something that you're different from what you believe.
That's right. Now, that's not the only measure of religious tolerance or religious acceptance that we have in our book, but it's an important one. And it's striking, the overwhelming percentage of Americans, even those who are in religious traditions, say they're evangelical Christians, where you would expect them to be, you know, pretty specific about who it is who gets to go to heaven based on their theology. That is actually not the case, that even in groups that have pretty strict religious beliefs, you nonetheless find an overwhelming majority endorsing the idea that good people, not necessarily of their religion, can go to heaven, even when we specify that that person is not Christian. You know, it would be one thing to say that the Methodists think it's okay for the Presbyterians, and that the Episcopalians, you know, they say that the Lutherans can go to heaven. But it's quite another for a Baptist to say that someone who is Jewish or even someone who is Muslim can go to heaven. But that's what we find in a majority of cases.
Now, it also is the case, though, that it seems that certain groups, that is, certain faiths, don't have the same, quite the same level of acceptance. So the Protestant Catholic thing has eased up. But for example, there, you know, we still have people who are Muslim, people who are Buddhist, I'm sure people who are Hindus, and Mormons still have some problems with acceptance.
That's exactly right. If you think of our data as providing a religious popularity contest, that's a little trite, but you can think of it loosely in those terms. What we find, and this is somewhat of a surprise for many people, is that Jews are actually at the very top of how people perceive other religions in the country, followed just narrowly by the Catholics. So Jews and Catholics are viewed very positively by the American public. And then at the lower end of the scale, you find less warmth, the way we would put it, toward the three groups you mentioned, Mormons, Muslims, and Buddhists. And what's very interesting about that is it's not just that Muslims are at the bottom of that list. It's that they're joined by these two other groups. And the Buddhists are especially interesting because, you know, Buddhism is a somewhat innocuous religion. You might perhaps understand why people would be a little ambivalent toward Muslims in the U.S. given the current political environment. But Buddhists are a different story altogether. There are no Buddhist terrorists. You know, Buddhists are pacifists. Why would they be viewed negatively? And the reason we think is that these are groups that are not well known in the United States, and in particular, most Americans don't actually know someone of that faith. And the Mormons, that's another group that falls near the bottom of that list. They fit that profile as well. This is a geographically concentrated group and not as well integrated into the rest of American society as, say, Catholics are.
Well, there is one thing that you pointed to it that can offer an explanation to all of this, that can try to offer some explanation for the fact that, you know, given that in the past there have been high levels of anti-Semitism and anti-Catholic feeling in this country, that now Catholics and Jews have this high level of acceptance. And on the other hand, we have the smaller groups like Buddhists and Mormons and Hindus and Muslims that are not as accepted. Sort of the same thing explains all of that, and it has to do with people's opportunities to get to know individuals of a different faith and become comfortable with them and accept the idea that they're my neighbors and they're just kind of like me. And so the opportunity to get to know somebody seems to make all the difference.
Exactly. And that's actually what we mean when we refer to America's grace. That's the fact that even though in some ways religion actually polarizes us, it certainly does politically. In many other ways, Americans have actually knit together a society that has people of many different religions interacting with one another, often within the same household. You know, a lot of people are startled to learn that over half of all marriages performed today are actually interfaith marriages. So that's one important way that people are exposed to those of other faiths. But even if it's not your spouse, it might be your child, it might be your best friend, it might be your neighbor. Or sometimes we like to refer to our Aunt Susan. She's that aunt of yours who you know is destined for heaven because she's the nicest person on earth. But Susan is of a different faith. Maybe you're a Methodist and she's Catholic, or maybe she's Jewish and you're Mormon. But whatever the combination, you know that she's destined for heaven, even though your faith tells you that, well, really, she's not going to go to heaven because she doesn't believe the same stuff you do. When faced with your theology versus your Aunt Susan, our data show that Aunt Susan wins almost every time.
Mm-hmm. So here is one of the two major themes that is certainly compared to other countries. The United States has very high levels of religious pluralism and also religious tolerance. So that's sort of on the one side. But then the other thing that you also look at that's been an important trend of the last few decades, say, again, of the post-war period, is this kind of widening gulf between people who are believers and people who are very strong believers, and then people who are, if not self-defined as atheists, at least they're not people who identify with a particular faith or who are active in a particular religious organization.
That's right. In fact, it was one of the most startling changes that's occurred over the last, say, 20 years or so in American society is the growth in the group of people that we call the nuns. Hmm. Now, we don't mean the N-U-N-S kind of nuns. We mean the N-O-N-E type of nuns.
As in none of the above.
Who, when asked, what's your religion, say, yes, nothing in particular or none of the above. The nuns, that group, they are currently the third largest religious, if you want to call them that, religious group in the United States at about 17% of the population. And they've grown rapidly since roughly 1990. It was right at the end of the 80s, the early 90s, that we began to see this rapid acceleration of people who say they have no religion. Now, that's different than saying they have no religious belief. Many of them actually say they do believe in God. And it's different than saying that they take the label of atheist. Mm-hmm. There are obviously some within that group who do, but many don't. They just sort of float along, and they don't really have a religion, and they're sort of unsure about, you know, what to do with the beliefs that they have. They don't really see a home for themselves in organized religion.
Mm. And what certainly one important trend that is involved in this spread between the people of faith and the nuns is that if you take a look at America going back, even really probably further back than the 50s, you see that it seems that each generation seems to be a little bit less religious than the one that went before. And over enough time, that spread gets pretty wide.
Well, yes, although another important thing to keep in mind is that in general, if you look over the course of American history, we actually have gone through periods where people have been more religious and less religious. And so the 1950s were arguably the most religious period in all of American history. So while you do see this slight generational change from that point forward, it does not necessarily mean that we would expect over the very long haul that America is just on its way toward European-style secularism. And another point to make is this growth in the nuns, because it's happened so suddenly, it's not simply a matter of one generation being replaced by another that's slightly less religious. This is something happening to people of a particular, you know, point in time who are reacting to what we think the political environment around them. That's what's leading to the growth of the nuns.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus is David Campbell. He is professor of political science at University of Notre Dame and is the co-author of a recently published book that's titled American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. It's published by Simon & Schuster and contains a great deal of information about Americans and their attitudes about religion and their participation in religion. And questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also send us email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, as you said, and it's certainly quite correct, maybe I was overstating this trend of youthful drifting away from religion. If you graph it out, and as you have, look at the degree of religious participation, again, say, go back to, you know, around the time of the Second World War, maybe a little bit before, what you see is around I think 1957 was the high point.
That's right.
Of American religion. You see this big bump in the 50s, which then resolves and goes down to the point we are now. So, and this contributes to this, to the in growth in the nuns and this this widening gulf between the people of strong faith and these other folks. So you have to look at that and say, well, what really was going on? And not only what was going on to create the big bump, but then what happened to for the big bump to fall off? And so we have this big decline that's been then fairly consistent since
right.
then.
Well, the way we describe it in the book is you can think of America as having gone through a seismic shock in the 1960s. Hmm. So we hit this high point of religiosity in the late 1950s. Then the 1960s come, and basically sex, drugs, and rock and roll change everything. And in particular, sexual mores begin to change, and therefore, as a consequence, people begin to divide along religious lines. So we see a drop-off in Americans' religiosity in the 60s, and that shock, which led to that drop-off, it was then followed by what we call the first aftershock. That is a group of Americans who said, wait a second, I don't like what's happening here, and turned to conservative religion. So that's mostly growth among the evangelicals. That happened in response to what we saw in the 60s. That conservative-style religion continued to grow through the 1980s, maybe through the early 90s, but has largely stopped now. And from that time forward, we've seen this growth in those who say they have no religion. What that all results in is a polarization along religious lines. So we have a large number of Americans who flocked to conservative religion in the wake of the first aftershock. Now we've had this growth in the nuns. We call that the second aftershock. And it means that we have fewer people in the middle of the religious spectrum. Instead, we've had people sort of clustering at two different ends that mean that they often don't see the world in the same way, and certainly their politics often play out differently.
Yeah. You know, one of the trends that you point to that sounds like you say is now maybe at least leveling off was this big trend that was happening within Protestantism, where we had growth in evangelical, so more conservative evangelical kind of congregations, and sort of a withering of the more mainline denominations. And you sort of wonder when you look at the nuns, and again, if what's interesting about a lot of these people is that they don't want to define themselves as atheists. So they don't say that they're completely non-believers, but you have to wonder if some of those people do have some kind of faith, why it is that they haven't found some church home somewhere, because you would think that in the great scheme of things, there could be some place that those people would feel comfortable. But obviously, no one seems to be able to figure out how to pick those people up.
Right, or the way we put it in the book, no one has done so
yet. Yeah.
We're actually reasonably confident that there will be religious innovators who will find a way to bring probably not all of that group, but some significant portion of that group, back to church in some way. And one way that we think this is likely to happen is to decouple evangelical-style religion, which is generally the most successful in going and finding new people and bringing them into the pews, to decouple that style of religion from the political connotation that it has now. Because that's what we think is actually driving the rise of the nuns. These are folks who have said, wait a second, if being religious means that I'm going to be thought of as a conservative Republican, well, that's not me. So if you ask me, do I have a religion, I'm going to say no, because when I hear religion, I'm actually hearing the question, are you a conservative Republican? Because they don't like to see this mixture of religion and politics. And if you could figure out a way to have the evangelical-style religion without the politics, well, that might be an attractive place for these folks to end up.
Yeah, it does seem it's interesting that on a couple of the two of the biggest hot button issues, homosexuality and attached to that gay marriage and abortion, those two things that have really galvanized a lot of people of faith, and then they have taken that and channeled that into political action. If you take a look, particularly over time, at and across generations at these issues, it seems like, generally speaking, that younger people just aren't they're sort of more ambivalent about abortion, and they're certainly more accepting to the idea of homosexuality in gay marriage. So you have to wonder, as going forward, if those issues lose their power to energize people and to for people to define themselves, well, what exactly is that going to mean?
Well, you've actually you put it very nicely, actually, to highlight these two somewhat contrasting trends, people moving in a more liberal direction on homosexual rights and particularly gay marriage, but then moving in the opposite direction, especially among young people, on abortion, which suggests that it's going to be hard to bundle those two issues together the way that they have been. It's probably too easy to predict the demise of the religious right because of those trend lines are moving in opposite directions. One thing that we've found over the last 20 or 30 years is that pretty well after every presidential election, a bunch of pundits claim that this is it, the religious right is dead, and then lo and behold, it returns again. So I think it's likely that there will be religious / political entrepreneurs who will try to tap into other social issues, perhaps, to rally the faithful. Not clear they'll be as successful, though, because, boy, when you look across the wide range of issues that are on the political agenda, nothing divides religious and secular folks like those social issues. It's not immigration. It's not economic policy. So it's not clear they'll be as successful as they have been in the past.
Yeah. Well, certainly one of the trends that we have seen over the last few decades is this increasing involvement of evangelical Christians in politics and bringing their concerns into the political arena. And you have found that it does tend to be true. That is, if you to a large extent, a person's religious identity can predict their political identity and the other way around. That may not be 100%, but there are some pretty close correlations, particularly between in defining yourself as a Republican or as a conservative, and whether you are also, say, a conservative evangelical when it comes to your church identification.
That's right. Now, I'm betting that most of your listeners will not be surprised to hear that, on average, people who are more religious are more likely to vote Republican or more likely to take the conservative side on any given issue. But a couple of important things to keep in mind about that factoid. One is that the most religious group in America, those are African Americans, and specifically what are known in the business as Black Protestants, so African Americans who attend a Protestant church, they are the most religious group in the American population and are also the most democratic. Well, what does that tell us? Well, it reminds us that there's no iron law that links conservative politics and religion. And we see further evidence of that when we just back up a little bit, instead of focusing on the current period and go back just 30, 40, 50 years, you see that there really was no religious divide in American politics. You know, when Dwight Eisenhower was elected president, there was no God gap. He was just as likely to get votes from folks who were in the pews and attend church regularly versus those who did not attend church regularly. And it reminds us that religion is always in flux in the United States, but so is the interplay between religion and politics. So, again, there's no iron law that links conservative politics and religion necessarily.
Something else that you find and which might surprise people and it might really go contrary to what they think is that your finding is that, contrary to, I think, what a lot of people on the left think, that in conservative evangelical churches, the clergy is not standing at the front of the congregation. They're not standing in the pulpit and they're telling their congregation how to vote.
That's right. In fact, this is one of the findings from our book that we often have the most difficulty convincing people that's actually true. What we find is that there is actually very little overt politicking over the pulpit, by which we mean, you know, endorsements from clergy or even just political talk coming over the pulpit in conservative-leaning churches. You don't find much of that really in any American place of worship, but if you are going to find it, it's more likely on the left rather than the right. You are more likely to find it in liberal churches, and I don't just mean black churches. I mean, you know, that's true in mainline Protestant congregations as well. But, and this is absolutely critical, that doesn't mean that there's no politics happening in those more conservative churches. It just means it's not coming over the pulpit. We call it the echo chamber effect. These are like-minded people who have clustered together in a congregation, and so they reinforce each other's political attitudes, not necessarily from the sermons that they hear, but from the conversations they have in the hallway, in the lessons that they teach one another, in the emails that they pass around, those sorts of things.
Well, I would expect that these are people who know what they believe, who know what is important to them, and they probably also know, when it comes to people running for office, which candidates represent their points of view. So it seems that you wouldn't have to tell people who to vote for. They don't need to be told who to vote for. Perhaps what you want to do is you need to mobilize them to vote.
Yes, that's exactly right. The example that we provide of this in the book, and I should mention that in the book American Grace, while we have lots of data from these surveys that we discussed earlier, we also have some what we call vignettes of various congregations around the country. So if you're more of a word person as compared to a data person, there are lots of words there describing how different religious groups worship. And one of the groups we focused on that's relevant to this thread of conversation is a Mormon or an LDS congregation in Utah. And what's interesting in that particular congregation, not surprisingly, it's composed almost entirely of political conservatives. There are a few Democrats, believe it or not, in that congregation. But for the most part, these folks are Republicans and pretty conservative Republicans. But virtually nothing is ever said over the pulpit politically. It's exactly what you were saying. These are like-minded folks who are worshiping together. They share a lot of values and a worldview that's common. And therefore, they just sort of know who you're supposed to vote for, and they reinforce that in their interactions with one another.
We are about midway through this part of Focus. Let me introduce again the guest, David Campbell. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at University of Notre Dame, where he's also founding director of the Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy. He's interested in religion, politics, and public policy. He is the co-author, along with Robert Putnam from Harvard, of the book American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. It's published by Simon & Schuster and presents the results of a lot of work that they've done, including a couple of really quite major and comprehensive surveys of religious attitudes of Americans. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call. We also have a toll-free, that's 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. There's another area that I want to have you talk about that I think is quite interesting. And while it is the case, I think generally speaking, that people tend to adopt the religions that they were born into, and that's true here in the United States, that perhaps maybe more than some other places, Americans switch. If they don't find the faith maybe that they were given, that were handed to them by their parents, if they don't find that satisfying, there are people who will go out and try to find another one. What is it that influences religious switching? And in fact, is that something you see more in the United States than other places?
We see far more religious switching in the U.S. than in most other countries. Many of your listeners might be surprised to hear that roughly a third of all Americans switch religions at some point in their life. And when we say a switch, we don't just mean a subtle change from a Presbyterian to a Lutheran congregation. We mean switching from one entire religious tradition to another, so maybe moving from Protestant to Catholic, for example. And you find more of that in the U.S. than you do in most other countries, largely because we have a very vibrant, might even call it a competitive religious environment. I like to think of it as being like an ecosphere, as you have lots of new species being created all the time in terms of religion. And so there's a lot happening on the side of religious entrepreneurs trying to, you know, woo people into their particular congregations. And so you find a lot of switching, often for family reasons, but sometimes it's because people just find a new place. They see a church down the street, and they check it out, and they decide that that's more to their liking than the one they had been attending. And it's really a remarkable thing, and it's what actually has fostered this intermingling between people of different religions that we also discussed earlier. It's how we come to know people of different faiths. It's because our friends are switching all the time. And so you may yourself not ever change your religion, but chances are you're going to know people close to you who do at some point in their life move from one faith to another.
Yeah, that's there seems to be this remarkable amount of religious mobility. And if you count both not only people who, Baptists who become Buddhists, but also Baptists who attend one particular Baptist church, and for some reason they find that not satisfying, so they go looking for another another congregation. So rather than a completely different change, they're looking for maybe a smaller change. You put that all in together, that it seems remarkable, and maybe again that says something about America, that people should feel so free and that they have the opportunities to do that.
Yeah, we found that even with only a passage of time of 1 year, so we did one survey and then we went back to the same people roughly a year later and interviewed them. We found that even over that short period of time, a pretty hefty percentage, or something like 10% of our sample, switched congregations. And that's just in 1 year. When you multiply that over year after year after year, you find an awful amount of, awfully high amount of flux, as we might put it, in the religious environment. People are just moving back and forth from one place to another.
Well, we have a call here. We certainly would welcome others. Let me give you the numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. The toll-free, 800-222-9455. And then if you'd like to send in your comment by email, that is will-talk@illinois.edu. I think we have a caller here ready to go on our line number one. Let us do that. Hello.
You were talking about the nuns being about 17%. I was wondering how many people actually say they are atheists or agnostic.
That's a very good question. What percentage of that group say they're atheist or agnostic? In our survey, we actually find a pretty small percentage. So we interviewed roughly 3,100 people, and around five of them took the label of atheist or agnostic. That's a small fraction of our survey, but when you multiply that over 300 million Americans, that actually does result in a sizable group. And the other thing to note about the atheist / agnostic population is that there's every reason to think that this is a growing group, because as the percentage of people who say they have no religion overall is growing, we would expect the percentage of atheists to grow. So I suspect that if we have this conversation, say, 5 years from now, we would find far more people in a survey like this actually taking that label on as an atheist or an agnostic.
And also, how accepting is religion in general of people who have no faith?
Well, that's a good question. It kind of depends on how you ask it of people. So if you ask Americans how they feel about someone who is not religious, if you just put it in those terms, you actually find that those folks are viewed about the same as evangelical Protestants and viewed more positively than, say, the groups we discussed earlier, the Muslims and the Buddhists and the Mormons, who are sort of at the tail end of the quote-unquote popularity contest. If, however, instead of saying people who are not religious, you describe people who are atheists. How do you feel about atheists? That's a different story. That's a term, atheist, that's quite loaded and is viewed very negatively, would probably be at the very bottom of the list. So in terms of accepting folks who explicitly take on that label, we have a ways to go yet in American society.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier, you talked a little earlier about some of the big shocks that happened since the 60s to change American religion, and particularly these things that contributed to the growth of the nuns, as in none of the above. When you ask people, are you involved in a church? Do you attach yourself to a particular faith? And they say no. And we did note that when you graph out people's, plot out people's religious participation, it seems that the high point, the golden age of American religion, was 1957. Not earlier ages, when there, of course, have been big, great awakenings and a lot of religious fervor. What was happening in 1957 to create this surge in religious activity?
Well, the first thing to note is when you see a surge in religious activity at any point in American history, it's actually due to men going to church. So women are more religious than men on average, and in periods of high religiosity, generally what explains that is you're just finding more men in the pews. So in the post-war era, you had a number of GIs who had returned from the war. They were settling down. This was the area, you know, era of the new suburbs, and everybody owned a station wagon and all that kind of stuff. And going to church was a sign of middle-class respectability. It was also an expression of patriotism, because remember that in the 1950s, we were in the thick of the Cold War against the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, which were avowedly atheist countries. And so the United States did a lot of things in the 1950s to sort of reinforce itself as a God-fearing country. It's when the phrase "under God" was added to the Pledge of Allegiance, for example. It's when "In God We Trust" was made the official motto of the United States. And then, you know, on the individual level, you had lots of people who gravitated toward church because that was just what you did if you were a respectable middle-class American. Hmm.
We have a caller in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I have a comment on what you were talking about before on the involvement of religion in politics. I think I've seen enough where you've seen both sides of the spectrum try to co-opt religion, whether it's, you know, evangelicals on one side or the liberation theology on the other side. But I think if you're going to be, you know, truly consistent, I think a religious person, you know, has to avoid attachment to any political party or, you know, I mean, just I speak as a Catholic, for instance, we, you know, we oppose abortion and, you know, same-sex marriage, but also we've had problems like with the Iraq War or with some of the monetary and economic policies you see. So I think, you know, it's important to, you know, I think avoid political attachments if you're going to be really truly religious from my point of view.
Well, Professor Campbell, what do you think about that?
That's a very interesting and important point, because it turns out that over the course of most of American history, that's actually the way religion has operated in the political environment. It hasn't actually had a partisan overtone to it. You know, particular religions might be affiliated with a given policy position, say prohibition at one period or civil rights at another period. That's very different than being wrapped up in the mantle of a particular party, which is increasingly what has happened today in politics. And what's interesting as well, the caller noted, you know, he noted that he himself was Catholic and therefore was sort of conflicted, because on the one hand there were some issues that the Catholic Church would endorse on abortion and gay marriage that might put them on the right, but then there are other issues that might put them on the political left. We find that the Catholics as a population are a very interesting group for precisely that reason, that they often are somewhat divided in a way that, say, the evangelicals in the population are not. And that stems directly from the teachings that are found within the faith.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right. Again, other calls are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Our guest is David Campbell. He is a professor, associate professor of political science at University of Notre Dame. He is the co-author, along with Robert Putnam, of the book American Grace, Our Religion Divides and Unites Us. It's recently out, published by Simon & Schuster. One of the things, it seems that if you talk to people about their personal involvement with religion, particularly people who say maybe when they were younger, when they were kids, they were a part of a church, and then they sort of drifted away when they became adolescents and young adults. One thing that seems to be really a powerful force to draw people back to religion is having children. Is that still the case, or has there been some breaking of that sort of trend where people say, well, once you become a parent, you start thinking about your kids, you start thinking about the importance of being involved in a church again?
It is still the case. So as people get married, settle down, have kids, they're more likely to return to church if they have not been attending or have not thought of themselves as religious. What's interesting, though, about today's young people is that there are two factors that are sort of working against them returning to religion in the same way that their parents' generation or certainly their grandparents' generation did. The first is they get married later, they have kids later. But more importantly, perhaps, is the fact that they are starting as a group in the population, they're starting at a lower level of religiosity than their parents' or grandparents' generation. So even if we see the same growth in religion among today's young people as they have children and decide to return to church, even if that growth is exactly the same as, say, their parents, they still won't reach the same level as their parents because they're starting at a much, much lower point, which suggests that going forward, you know, we may not be as religious a country, but, you know, it's a little unclear exactly how these things will work out. Prediction is hard, especially about the future, as Yogi Berra said.
Let's talk with some other folks here. Indiana is next, line number four. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to get something straight because I'm trying to get a visual of this piece of paper you're having people either check off things and none of above. I've seen them before. What I'm concerned about is you're talking, you put the agnostics and the atheists together. Epistemologically, that's silly. I wonder why you do it. Is it because it's simply they're not saying, I believe in a God? And do you keep separate runnings on the agnostics and the atheists, what percentages, rather than just a grouping all together? Thanks.
Okay. That's actually a very good question, and I'm glad the caller has given us reason to clarify that. So, of course, an atheist is somebody who says, I don't believe in God, and an agnostic is somebody who says, well, I'm not sure whether there's a God or not. In our survey, people could choose either one of those labels. They could, you know, say I'm an atheist or say that I'm an agnostic. We've just found that when talking with public audiences about our results that many people seem to naturally group those two together, so that's how I've been talking about them here. I think what you'd find, though, if you were to actually parse that out and separate the atheists from the agnostics, is the agnostics are a larger group, as you might expect. But given the current trends, I would expect the proportion of the American population who say they don't have a belief in God, you know, who are explicitly atheists, to grow. And we've certainly seen evidence of that just over the last few years. And they're becoming a more public presence as well. Just today I read in the New York Times about a campaign on the part of some atheists around the country to sort of remind Americans that they exist and maybe even, in a sense, proselytize for the atheist cause.
Well, and it also seems to get a lot more complicated because I suppose you could have a person and you could say to them, do you believe in God? And they might say yes, or they might say maybe, or you might say, do you consider yourself a spiritual person? And they might say yes. But then if you say to them, are you involved in a church? They'd say no. Do you attend regular services? They'd say no. Does religion play a very big role in your life? They'd say no.
Right.
So what do you do with where do you put that person?
Well, this is actually what makes the study of religion so much fun, although you could also say it's somewhat complex because you get a lot of people actually who are exactly as you describe. So on the one hand, we and others who study religion as social scientists, we talk about religious belonging, by which we mean the group to which you belong or the identity which you might claim. So you might say you're a Catholic, even though you never actually attend Mass and in no other way sort of express your Catholicism, you still carry that identity around in your head. Well, that could be true actually for somebody who is a non-believer. They may, you know, carry in their head the image of, well, I'm an atheist, that's what I am. On the other hand, you might find people who haven't actually taken that label on. They may not even have a label. Therefore, they're the none of the above folks. But then when you turn to these questions about their beliefs or about their behavior, we get a very different pattern. So some of those folks, they might not be sure what label to take, but in every respect, they seem to be non-believers. They, you know, say, I don't believe in God, and I certainly don't have a church, and I certainly don't contribute any money to a church or anything like that. But then you'd also find some folks who might take on a label. They might say they're agnostic, but nonetheless, they do say, yeah, actually, I have a church, or yes, I do actually contribute money or time to a religious cause. There's actually more of those Americans than you might think.
All right. Well, again, we have just about 5 minutes. I have several callers. We'll try to get one or two. People will really help us by being brief. We'll go next to Effingham, line one. Hello.
Yes. The subject matter is about childish behavior. When the child is arrested in his development and God is suggested to them, then they go from there. Adolescents, then they are taught to be killers, and they do that, and the whole thing is disrupted by money. Thank you.
Well, I'm not really sure what to do with that, Professor Campbell. You have any thought?
I'm not sure if he was drawing a parallel to young people who are introduced to a religion. I'm not entirely sure.
I'll just have to let that stand and go on to a caller here in Urbana on line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Is that me?
Yes.
I don't know if you've talked about Unitarian Universalism yet. Has that come up? I've not been able to hear the first part of the program.
No? Did you have something specific?
Well, as a Unitarian Universalist, I find this a fascinating topic, and I wondered if in the research they found other Unitarian Universalists and what percentage they might have identified. Because when I first found it, I realized, hey, here's a church or a denomination that recognizes the good in all religions. And so on a Sunday service, I might hear about Buddhism, I might hear about Hinduism or Islam or a whole variety of things. We have everything from pagans to people that are very religious within whatever their framework is. And I find that to be hopeful that maybe more of us can identify with that in the future rather than having everyone saying, oh, my belief in a higher power is correct, no, my belief is correct, and let's go kill a lot of people over our beliefs. So I'm just curious whether anything like that came up in your research.
Well, thank you for the comment. As you would expect in a sample of the American population, we do have Unitarian Universalists within our group, not a terribly large group numerically, so we don't break them out on their own. Because of the rather distinctive beliefs of the Unitarians, they actually kind of get grouped in a catch-all category. But I can say that in the various presentations and interviews that we've done, pretty well every time, actually, I've spoken to an audience, there's been at least one Unitarian in the audience who's wanted to come up and chat with me, because I actually find a lot of the things we say in the book seem to resonate with the Unitarian Universalist worldview, which is, again, this image of America as a somewhat accepting place of other religions, and certainly the Unitarians are on the leading edge of that.
Well, I find it, as someone, that it never made sense to me when I was growing up that one religion had it over another, but I always had the sense of some form of higher power, and to me that higher power is just the energy force behind all matter and all the driving force, and all the different religions are what people have made up within their framework or their context over the centuries. Mm-hmm. And it just seems so strange now that we're all fighting each other over, what was it, Khalil Gibran said, there are many ways to the top of the mountain. And I really wish that we could get more people back to that kind of a belief or mindset. So we're out there trying to recruit Unitarian Universalists, and if anyone hearing about this on the radio program, come check out our local congregation.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
And there's an example of American religious entrepreneurship at work.
We're coming down here to the point where we just have a couple of minutes left. And one thing, point that I really want to try to get to, and we've talked about some of the big changes in America in the last half century. And again, sort of your basic theme is we have two interesting things going on that are somewhat in tension. One is that we have a lot of religious pluralism and actually a fairly high level of religious tolerance in this country. But also we have this increasing split between people of faith and often people with a very intense commitment to their faith and people who say that they don't have any faith or at least they don't belong to an established religion. And, you know, we've talked about some of the big things that have come along that have shaken American society and affected religion as well, things like that we really haven't really talked very much about, but you can talk about the women's movement. You talk about the civil rights movement, and you can talk about simple demographics. All of that leading to this question, all right, where is American religion going? And is it possible that something, and I think it's probably been a long time since anybody really did anything new, is it possible that there is something new on the horizon?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, American religion is only going to get more diverse going forward. Whether or not we'll continue to see this upward trend in the percentage of Americans who say they have no religion, that I'm less sure of. But I am quite confident that you're going to continue to see many new religions and religions imported from other nations, particularly from Eastern countries, proliferate in the United States. You're only going to see more Muslims and more Hindus and more Sikhs and more Buddhists. Now, as to whether or not we'll see a new form of religion, that's also hard to say, but I'm reasonably confident that at least within our existing religious traditions, say Protestantism, for example, you are likely to see religious entrepreneurs trying to reach out to this group of folks who say they have no religion, but nonetheless have not totally walked away from religion. They might be willing to at least consider the possibility that there's a God, or they might even say, well, yeah, I do believe in God. I just haven't had found a home in religion. And in the book, we actually describe some possible ways that you might find religious entrepreneurs reaching out to that group.
Mm. And so you also think that some of the religious groups that you've talked about, those that tend to not have as much exposure, or that is that many Americans are not exposed to them, Muslims particularly, but also, again, you'd have to, I'm sure, include Hindus and Buddhists. If their numbers do grow, they become more visible, people have the opportunity to get to know them, your surmise would be that in terms of their being included and accepted, that's what's going to make the difference.
That's what our history suggests. Now, there's a caveat there, which is we would only expect these groups that are now viewed negatively to be viewed more warmly if they do actually mix and mingle in the rest of society. So if it were the case that any given population were to hunker down and withdraw from their neighbors, and therefore not build those ties across religious lines, then we would not expect them to be viewed more warmly.
Hmm. We are at the point here we're going to have to finish up and just say to our guest, thanks very much, our guest David Campbell. He is the John Cardinal O'Hara Associate Professor of Political Science at University of Notre Dame. He's also founding director of the Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy. He is the co-author, along with Robert Putnam from Harvard, co-author of the book American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. Book's recently been published by Simon & Schuster. And to Professor Campbell, thank you very much for talking
with
us.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed this. It's been wonderful.